Hey, Chris.
Hey, Eddie, what's up?
You know how we both love Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men?
Oh, yeah, it's a great X-Men podcast.
Totally, and it got me thinking. Maybe we should do an episode on X-Men 97.
I'd love that, but it seems like you're confused about something.
Yeah, I just don't know how Morph fits into the show. Didn't they die?
Yep, in Night of the Sentinels, which was a two-part series premiere of the original X-Men, the animated series.
Right, so how are they alive now?
They were resurrected by Mr. Sinister until Death Do Us Part, which was a season two premiere.
Okay, but how do they know all the other people that they change into?
What do you mean?
Well, in just four episodes, they change into Charles Xavier, Jean Grey, Blue Bionic Archangel, Lady Deathstrike, Colossus, Ninja Psylocke, Sabretooth, Spiral, Magic Anne, the Dark Child, and Morph was dead for some of those.
Well, you know who they haven't turned into?
Who?
Me, I'm Chris Spivey.
And I'm Eddie Webb.
And today we'll cover X-Men 97 here on Genreless. Do-do-do-do. I love our journalist theme. I think to myself sometimes that maybe I've heard it too much, but every time I hear it, I find myself uncontrollably bobbing my head, just ever so
I know,
slightly.
right? Right? I'm very pleased with that selection. And I'm also very pleased that you put up my shenanigans with my proposal for a Jay and Miles inspired cold open. So
Well, we both love Jay and Miles and what they do, and we've talked about them repeatedly on the podcast, even when we weren't covering X-Men or superheroes, just in general. Do you know Jay and Miles seemed like they're pretty awesome people. It
They're
like
honestly, it's just a great. They're just a great media podcast. I mean, so yeah, no, I'm happy to give them a shout out. But I was like, if anything we're gonna do is gonna inspire an homage to their quote open style, it has to be X-Men 97.
Do you know that because of all of our current X-Men 97 shenanigans that you agree to for some reason, I've actually re-listened to the first couple episodes of their podcast, and then I sort of jumped around to specific ones to see if I wanted to use a character they were discussing in an episode, but I chose
Oh,
not
yeah.
to. But I haven't decided yet because anyone that knows me knows that when we do our special, I am going to come in about 95% unprepared.
That's 5% more prepared than usual.
Well, that's because there are other people involved, so I felt that I needed to help those other five people be prepared for my unpreparedness.
That says I'm talking about X-Men podcasts, and it's relevant, kind of, if you like really long form podcast. There's another one called Cerebro,
Yeah,
where what they
it's
do
pretty awesome.
is they focus on one character per episode, and sometimes episodes go like 4 or 5 hours.
Do you know how I discovered the Cerebro podcast?
No, how did you?
Jay and Miles explained the X-Men. We're
What a
talking
weird
about it, and they're like,
coincidence.
hey, Cerebro does this, this, and this, and along. It was like, ooh, let me look that up. And I found it, and I was like, oh, that is pretty cool.
Yeah. It's interesting that there's this kind of interesting growing subgenre of queer X-Men podcasts. I think that's very, very cool.
But we're not here to talk about the greatness of Jay and Miles. No, we're here to focus about X-Men 97, maybe touch on the original animated series, maybe for Eddie to tell us what a mutant is and how all the X-Men came into being. Go, Eddie, go. Start right now at the very beginning. Too slow. Keep going.
So Jack Kirby thought a word sounded cool and started using it in his scripts, and that's where we are today. He's like, what if we did an entire comic around two words, mutants and magnetism, and that's everything. We just put everything around that. What do they
Well,
mean? Don't care. They sound cool.
magnetism is the greatest power. You can do anything with
Oh, especially in the 60s, man. It was ridiculous. My favorite stupid magnetism moment, which is actually the most plausible out of all of them, which is telling, is when Magneto trying to get the X-Men to come to him, to come at me, bro. And so, because Magneto is super extra, wrote in the sky with iron filings a message to Charles Xavier and signed it in cursive specifically. And it's just like, okay, sure.
All right. So as always, we've not figured out how we want to approach this. My question is, do we want to go back and talk about the origins of the X-Men and talk about some of the comics? Do we want to stick strictly to the X-Men 97 series, which, and take a toe dip into the original animated series? Or do we want to talk about some of the different animated X-Men series that appear to get us to this point? Do we instead just want to talk about the team? There are so many avenues to explore and yet a finite amount of time.
Well, considering that one of the podcasts you mentioned has now have 400 episodes discussing the X-Men and they're only to the late 90s, I think maybe we should keep it confined to just the animated properties.
All right. Mr. Professionalism, we can do that.
And as far as I know, I actually think the first one was the 90s one, although there was a pilot we know of that was in the late 80s called Pride of the X-Men, I'm pretty sure.
Kitty Pride.
Right.
One of the greatest X-Men ever.
They did a pilot. Wolverine was Australian for some reason. And it was... If I remember correctly, it was done kind of in the spirit of the Transformers, G.I. Joe, Thundercats era of action cartoon toy things. And it just never got picked up.
And if I remember right, it wasn't that bad. It was all right.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty okay for what they're shooting for. And then fast forward to briefly touch on the comics, the Jim Lee-inspired reboot in 1991. X-Men became the number one selling comic book of all time for a very long time as a result of that. And suddenly,
well, they were always kind of, after the 60s run, sort of like when Claremont took over, they became super hot commodity themselves for a long time. And then for that 91 run that you're talking about, they became like number one. But they also, if I remember right, published a whole bunch of different variant covers and did a whole bunch of other marketing to make it be a number one. Like, they created that situation to have it be that. Not, and it was good, but I don't know if it was number one good.
No. So I actually looked into this a while back. First of all, everything you hate about 90s comics is all the fault of X-Men number one. I mean, that's just fact, because of variant cover crap, how the look of the characters. X-Men number one changed how comics were made. It was a landmark thing because it sold so many copies that record was not beaten until like maybe a decade or so later. It was the best-selling comic of all time. That one issue was. They had like multiple reprints. Although to be fair, they did actually print like 250,000 copies, and those sold out. And so they kept doing a couple, like I think 100,000 copy reprints, and a few of those ran out too.
So a tidbit I picked up from my Jan Miles listening, though, is that while they sold all those copies, I think it worked in the idea that the comic book shops bought them. So while the company sold them, the comic book shops had them, but the comic shops may not have sold all the copies they purchased because they anticipated it being a high run.
Well, right. I mean, that's...
So that's like the weird science and math behind it being a...
we're talking about the comic book, I guess. But it's relevant for this conversation because... You're right. How I think it still works this way, which is just awful. But how comic books publishers, they sell to the comic book stores, the comic book stores purchase them, and then the comic book stores sell on to the customers. Which is why you can find some of these 90s comics for dirt cheap right now, because what was happening is comic book shops were buying them, and certain titles were selling really well for them in certain areas. And so everyone thought, oh, I can replicate that success, not realizing that comic book reading is very regionalized as a hobby. And there's also no way for comic book shops to return unsold product, unlike in book publishing.
Yep.
But television producers did not care about that nuance. All they saw was what Marvel showed them, which was that we have sold this many copies to distributors, and they have not returned them, so ergo, there must be success. Omitting the fact is they can't return them. Fox at that point was looking to, I believe they had just broken off as a television network, but they were trying to launch their Fox Kids initiative, which was cartoons. And they had some success in not only showing older cartoons, but also the couple of early commissions exclusive to Fox cartoons were successful. So I wanted to expand that. And around the time that X-Men number one was selling really well, Batman animated series really took off. And so Fox wanted their take on that. And so that's where X-Men the animated series came from, as I understand it.
Awesome.
Why do I know this stuff, Chris? Why is this stuff in my head?
Because that is what you do. You love your deep dives, and then you go and you just don't do like a little deep dive internet research like one half of the podcast. Instead, you go out and you purchase books by the people that wrote extensively about them in great detail. And not one or two books, but like 8 books on one topic to read through them to learn it. And then it's in your brain for moments like this.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to argue about that, but then I was like, oh no, yeah, I have Marvel The Untold, Comics The Untold Story where I got a good chunk of this from.
Yeah. And I do all that with history stuff. So right. Different sides.
To be fair, I am starting to get that with history. So, I mean, you know, it's both history to on some level, right? It's just, you know, it's a very specific media history. But I've been expanding to like more outlet history, but regardless. About the animated series, like there are lots of people who the animated series is their X-Men right now, right?
Oh, yeah.
People growing up who like and what's fascinating is that what the animated series kind of did to reasonable success is they basically rewrote a lot of the high points of the comic book series, which was interesting because the X-Men team has not stayed static, and they specifically wanted to use the Jim Lee version of the team. So they wanted to visually to connect to comic books, which makes no sense. But, you know, it's ostensibly set in the continuity of the comic books, which just, if you think about it too hard, it just falls apart immediately. But like the fact that the original X-Men existed is referenced.
To some extent. Because it's weird, because Angel pops up, I think, right. In the original run, but Angel and Cyclops don't have that sort of we've been on the team together relationship.
Right. Similarly, Nightcrawler comes up, and he's been on the X-Men before, and he references being X-Men before, but, you know, there are characters who don't recognize him at all, even though they've worked with him regularly. So it's deeply weird. And also they tell some of the stories a bit out of order, but their continuity was intended to be reasonably cohesive inside the cartoon, but they were telling a relatively serialized cartoon at a time period where television executives didn't want that and didn't know how to handle that. I mean, you know, X-Men, I mean, people talk about how Babylon 5 kind of changed the landscape for serialized television, but X-Men was kind of doing the same thing on a much smaller scale at roughly the same time period. But a lot of times, stories are shown out of order. Unless they're explicitly marked part 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the continuity of the stories were often shuffled around, and sometimes they were even produced out of order. So there are things in later seasons that really should be watched in earlier seasons. So there is a coherent continuity, but most people remember that, but if you actually try to watch the series, it starts to fall apart, combined with the fact that also it was produced very quickly, and so some of the animation is just got awful.
Well, it gets really bad towards the end, around like season five's animation is nigh unwatchable, because
they had their budget slashed.
Yeah, one of the things I was doing over the past year or two is I started rewatching the series with my daughter, who to get her into X-Men. And we watched maybe the first 3.5 seasons before it sort of fell off and we started getting other activities going on. But in preparation for doing this, I decided, you know what? I want to rewatch the last episode because I haven't seen the last episode of the series since it first aired when I was a kid. And I couldn't watch it. It was so bad. I was like, is that Rogue? Maybe that's Rogue. Is that Cyclops?
Yeah.
Why does Cyclops look like that? Beast, I know Beast because he's still blue. He's the only blue person on the screen.
Right. So,
and he's in a little hat and a trench coat, which is Beast disguise, regardless of where he goes.
Impenetrable disguise, as we previously discussed. But it reminds me that there are a lot of people who have very strong fondness for really all media. And most of the time, they're really thinking about the first season or two of it. And yeah. X-Men animated series is definitely that. Like, a lot of people go, oh, it's a great show. And the first couple of seasons are actually pretty strong. But after that, it starts to really fall apart and actually leads to one of its bigger sins, which is going to be relevant to our discussion of 97, is that they all start speed running storylines really bad right around season three. Like, season one and two, they do things like, we're going to get five episodes of the Dark Phoenix saga. You know, they're going to really spun out. But then
season two is like a whole season almost of the Savage Land, which is a little too much of the Savage Land.
Oh God. Yeah. I mean, it's like, yes, I know in the original comics, they spent like a million years in Savage Lands, but I don't want to spend a million years watching the Savage Lands.
Though admittedly, I think if they had more Sauron in his jump shorts, in his pterodactyl form, it would have been even better than the little bit I think that we got.
Sauron is the best dinosaur vampire in the world. Absolutely. 100% hands down.
Love it. Well, but this podcast is known for having a penchant for liking vampire variants, just like
Doctor Who. Like space vampires. But no, so like in later seasons, they compressed an entire New Mutants arc, which lasted like 20 issues, into one episode.
Yeah.
So when they realized they were getting popular and they realized there were certain fan arcs that people really wanted to see, they started really heavily compressing them, and people started going, oh, well, this is just a bunch of stuff that happens. I don't care about this, because that's not what X-Men is a soap opera on some level. And if you take that part out and it just becomes people punching each other, it loses a lot of what makes it specifically interesting. Well, there's lots of other things that are interesting, but that's one of the bigger parts, particularly during the Claremont run.
Well, also, if from the 90s kids animated version, there's only so much punching they can do because they can't kill anyone. They could potentially, I think, destroy them. They could batter them. And you can't show realistic guns, so they would have their little guns that shoot energy beams that do specific things. I don't remember Wolverine ever slashing a person.
No.
Except maybe a Reaver.
He can destroy walls. He can destroy robots. But yeah, when you have an entire concept where your big star character is literally a guy with murder knives on his fists and going, yeah, but you can't show blood or kill anybody. Wolverine has some interesting complications.
And so before we transition properly into X-Men 97, I am going to make us take a step back to talk about after the X-Men animated series went aired, they tried to create a few other X-Men shows before this happened.
Okay. Yeah.
There was X-Men Evolution that I think was on the Cartoon Network that ran for about three seasons. No, sorry. I think that was right. Because X-Men, that show started, which I did not enjoy. It wasn't for me. I think I'd aged out of that range at that point.
It was X-Men almost in high school, so yeah.
So it wasn't for me. Then they tried Wolverine and the X-Men, which, all right, Chris hot take, in case you didn't know, I don't like Wolverine. I don't. I think Wolverine is a trash character that is not a team player. And I understand they've continued to try to slot Logan into being a team player and like team leader. And it synthetically goes against the grain of that character. And it doesn't work for me as a viewer and a reader. So Wolverine and the X-Men, Wolverine leading the X-Men with a depressed Cyclops, struck all the wrong chords. So I didn't really enjoy that series either.
The only character who's probably more overexposed than Wolverine is maybe Deadpool. And so it would be terrible if someone took those two really horribly overexposed characters and shoved them into a movie together.
Yeah. Unless it's Ryan Reynolds, who seems to not be able to fail regardless of what he does. Right. What? A football team that has been failing for years, that is an institution, let me come and purchase your team and give you a bunch of money to improve your odds. It takes us three seasons, but I think they're winning a lot now.
Hey,
Wrexham, baby! Wrexham!
This gin company that doesn't even be able to sell very well, I'm going to go and buy it and just make commercials with me in it, and now suddenly it's one of the better selling gin brands in the world. Okay.
So, it could be a thing. I don't like Wolverine. I've said it. I put it out there. Even before Wolverine was oversaturated. Meh. So that didn't work for me. But I think there was the anime version of X-Men, which was super cool to watch and an interesting, slightly different take, which if you haven't seen
that it. That was around the movies, right?
Yeah. Which is an interesting watch. I would suggest just going and seeing it. It's only one season. Mm-hmm. And then we're at the point now where years went by, and that's when Bo DeMeo, who at time of recording is no longer working with Marvel, they were let go fired. A lot of ambiguity around what occurred, but they're the person that pitched the new animated series to Marvel, did the writing, the executive producing, and everything else for the first two seasons of the show. Mm-hmm. The reason that the show right now is a bona fide success and killing it is from the work they did, and they were let go right before the show aired. I think as of now, they've come out and made a statement that episode 5 that's aired recently was their pitch to Marvel that got all this happened. And episode 5, if you haven't seen it, ooh.
I have not yet, so.
Man, that is the one you need to watch.
Okay. Actually, I take it back. I may have watched that one.
Good stuff.
I think they watched one. But anyway, we're not going to talk about that one. We're going to talk right after that one, so.
And it's received a lot of critical acclaim right now. People are loving it. It was one of the top 5 streaming shows the week it aired. So off the charts awesome. And of course, since Disney put it out, there's hate from it because it was Disney. And then if you want to go find a troll is complaining that X-Men is woke, which means they've never read an X-Men comic or seen an X-Men show or have an understanding. I love when
people say Doctor Who and X-Men are woke as if like it's some new fucking thing. It's just like, buddy, no, you lack media comprehension. You need to stop.
And before we really go into the series synopsis or anything else, I want to give a serious shout out to some of the cast that chose not to reprise their roles so that those roles could go to people that those roles represent. Like, that is huge.
Yeah.
To see like this thing that you did to ask to come back for it and for you to step aside for someone else of that group to come and be able to do that role is astounding.
Yeah, because for those who don't know, voice acting and audio work, it was believed that anyone could fill any role, which generally meant white people did all of the voices.
Thank you.
That's where I was going. Don't worry. That was the ideal versus what actually happens. And so it was very common for characters of color to be portrayed by white people, by white voice actors. That is something that thankfully has been trending. And when this came about, all the original voice actors were approached and they had to audition. I have since found out they had to audition for their roles again. But some of them did specifically proactively step aside and saying, I do not want to reprise that role because I am a white actor and I do not feel comfortable doing this anymore. And I was like, I deeply appreciate them doing that.
And to the show's credit, then what it did is for some of those same people, they said, all right, you won't reprise that role, but please come on and we'll give you other roles that you could do.
Yep.
Like, that shows a show that cares about the casting, it cares about the people it's doing, and it cares about the integrity of the show itself.
Right. I don't completely agree with the results of that overall decisions, but we'll get into those. Generally, the new people cast have been great. I'll preemptively say that. I think some people maybe shouldn't have come back. Let's put it that way.
Some of them do make the characters sound older than what they appear to be.
Right. And I thought I would have more tolerance to that, considering I listen to Big Finish a lot, and it's people playing roles they played in the 70s, trying to play them again. But turns out I wasn't able to do it for some of these characters.
Well, if I can...
We're talking about Rogue.
I was going to say that it's specifically because for Big Finish, you see the box cover art, but then you don't see the person saying those lines. So you're imagining what they look like, which is a different experience than physically watching the character on screen and hearing that voice as they interact and do things. There's a different connection to that, which goes to a larger conversation about what media influences us and which one does it with different impacts.
But go back a little bit. Since we're talking about the show being pitched, we will get to the show props. But there's a lot to talk about.
It's us. We can meander around and then just cancel right before we even discuss the show itself. You know what? No serious synopsis this episode. Bye.
That would be very Fox-like to cancel it before it even airs. But one of the things that I appreciated about the show, and apparently part of the pitch, was that they were going to do it as if it were the next season of this show. But more specifically, including all of the broadcast's restrictions. They've since, as the show evolved, some of those have been lightened up a little bit because they felt they needed to really give some more textured things.
Well, they say the word kill now and some other things.
Right,
and they show them drinking alcohol.
Right. So I mean, like there's some of those that aren't there, but they're not, it's not like it's just, okay, it's Disney, we could do whatever. Right. It was they tried to at least keep to the spirit of the original kids cartoon in a lot of ways. And Chris and I have, before I've talked about how too faithful an adaptation can be stifling and frustrating. This is actually a good example, much like we talked about in the in an upcoming Patreon episode that will not spoil. But if it's a loose adaptation that hits the spirit of the thing it's adapting, but is willing to modify to fit what the current environment is now, that is usually the good sweet spot. And I feel like Set 97 really hits that sweet spot. It Absolutely. Feels like the image show you remember, not the one that actually existed.
Well, I think it's also a better understanding over the past 30 years compared to where kids are and the fact that adults are likely watching it too. So you're trying to like gauge that line between what is appropriate for a kid, but also what's appropriate for your actual fan base. You're going to be all the people full of nostalgia. And I think they hit it on the dot because I can watch X-Men 97. I've watched it with my daughter and she's loving it, like engaging with it how I engaged with the original series when it came out.
Which is
episode 5 was a little tough for adults and for her, but she still asked about, had questions about it afterwards, and it's still fun and she wants to keep watching it. And I keep saying and now, I'm falling in an old trap. I do want to point out that this show changed her favorite X-Men. Originally, she's, I love Storm and I love Jean Grey.
Uh-huh.
And now she loves Storm, Jean Grey, Bishop, and Magneto just because she loves his power set. It's like, I don't like him, but I want those powers.
Wow. The Magneto face turn is real.
So, just saying.
Nice. I mean, it's cool she likes Bishop because that's one thing. We're about to get into it, but I mean, just one thing I like the fact is that Bishop was kind of the reoccurring guest star in the original cartoon to the point where he was a de facto team member, but the way he became that was so sporadic that they never, he made the step. I'm glad they found it. No, Bishop is a member of the team now. I'm glad they made that step. And I mean, obviously, partially because it adds more diversity to the team, but also just Bishop adds a different dynamic to that specific 90s era of X-Men.
Oh, yeah.
That if you take him out, the X-Men are just different. And the original cartoon led to a slow burn of teasing him and slowly injecting him in. But I'm glad that 97 said, no, he's just part of the team now.
And the way they update all the powers and some of the costumes just a little bit was super impressive. And just sticking with Bishop, I like Bishop's representation of his power, how awesome it is, how it combines, and we'll talk about one of the episodes, how it combines with Cyclops, for instance, and how they have a greater effect. Like, that is good teamwork and team dynamics.
Well, I think we're ready to start talking about it. Are you ready?
Before we go on, I got one more piece.
Not ready. Okay.
Because I want to touch on Morph. And Morph's original introduction to the animated series, it was almost last minute. Because originally they were going to have Thunderbird be part of the team. And the Thunderbird arc was supposed to mirror what happened in the comics, which Thunderbird in the comics, if you haven't read it, for a spoiler from like 1975, goes on two missions and dies on the second mission. And the arc for Thunderbird in the series was going to be the same thing. And someone went, wait a second, are we going to really kill the only indigenous native person on the team two episodes in? We can't do that. And so in the 90s, someone spot checked themselves and made a course correction. Which, funnily enough, then you see Thunderbird, I think, pops up in one or two episodes. But nice. Like so many of the people, he then becomes a background character, which is kind of sad.
Well, right. And hilariously, Morph. So one thing I love about the cycle of inspiration, I like to think of it as, is that Morph was an exclusive original character to the animated series, then became popular. Even though he died and came back to life, that he then appeared in Marvel Comics. And the kind of spoilers for the original animated series, but there's like a glut of X-Men future apocalypse stories. where they go into the future and everything's horrible, but they're all slightly different. The animated series kind of just amalgamated all of those into one kind of general dystopic future. And that was so popular that it inspired the very popular, why am I blanking the name all of a sudden? The Age of Apocalypse run.
Uh-huh.
That actually was inspired because of how popular the, not quite the same as all the other Dark Futures was. And if my timing of the story beats is correct, I've not watched all the episodes, but I think there's a possibility that 97 may end up therefore doing their own version of the Age of Apocalypse, which would be a hilarious bit of cycling back, but.
That'd be kind of awesome. Like, I remember those because they broke out into all the X-Men comics having, like, it was like 4-issue runs of all the various teams and everything else. It was like Gambit and the Externals. You had, slight spoiler, Cyclops working for Apocalypse, I think, at the time. All sorts of great stuff.
It is, in fact, not only was it my first major exposure to X-Men, but it is the only run of X-Men that I still have collected in individual floppy issues. I love that run so much. But anyway.
Before we go on, who was your favorite character from the original animated series? Not the 97, the original.
You know what? Part of me wants to say Jubilee, but that's not quite accurate because Jubilee grated on me at times. And like you, I recognized that people liked Wolverine, but I didn't really gravitate to him for a long time. So honestly, probably Jean Grey, actually. Because I really liked her arc as a character.
Interesting. All right. Season 1, Episode 1. To me, my X-Men. 1 year after Henry Gyrick assassination attempt on Professor Xavier led to Xavier leaving Earth with the alien Shi'ar and being presumed dead, the X-Men continue his mission of defending mutants and humans alike. Xavier's supposed death has led to the X-Men being legally sanctioned by the UN. They save a young mutant, Robert DaCosta, aka Sunspot, from the anti-mutant group Friends of Humanity, FOH, who are using Sentinel technology. To find Sentinel creator Trask, the S-Men visit Gyrick in prison, and Cyclops offers him a deal that he can get out in 10 years instead of 25. And Gyrick laughs in their face, refusing, and so they pull out the secret weapon, Jean Grey. All right, I'm pausing. All the other people have code names. I've always been irritated by Jean Grey.
Jean Grey doesn't have a code name.
Yeah, Marvel Girl is not a real code name. I don't like it. Phoenix, like Phoenix. But she doesn't ever keep it. And then Phoenix went on to Rachel. I guess we're having a side digression in the middle of a summary of an animated series about the comic. Eddie, has Jean Grey ever had a good code name that is not related to an external cosmic entity that runs around in her body?
No. Next question.
Bakadachi. So Jean then invades his mind using Cerebro to amplify her psychic abilities. She locates Trask at a junkyard in the Sahara, but also receives a horrific premonition. The X-Men fly out there and destroy the remains of the Sentinels and Master Mold, the supercomputer at the junkyard, and apprehend Trask. Cyclops, a pregnant Jean, announces they are leaving the X-Men on the basketball court, is where so many other big revelations have happened for the X-Men, the comics, to raise their son in safety. They are interrupted when Beast's wrist alarm of the mansion security goes off. They rush into the mansion to find Magneto, the master of magnetism, who reveals that Xavier has given him control of the X-Men, all of his resources, the school for mutants, in his last will and testament that is for some reason in a very large, clunky metal book that Magneto floats around.
It doesn't have to be metal. It's magnetism.
It's just like the sonic screwdriver. It shouldn't work on wood.
But it does. Okay, so I just kind of want to take a step back. That first sentence of your summary, Henry Peter Gyrick assassination attempt on Charles Xavier led to Xavier leaving Earth with the alien Shi'ar being presumed dead. That is just fucking X-Men in a nutshell.
It's beautiful. And so
a government person tries to assassinate a private citizen. And so to avoid that, he takes off with a space space bird girlfriends and believes everyone believing he's dead.
What is that not? That's like a Tuesday in my household. Is that not happen over there?
But yes, honestly, so the first fight scene is straight up just let's reintroduce you to the characters, which is fine. Perfect.
No. Before you go there, I want to take a step back.
Okay.
You know what? I apologize because what I want to go happens after your fight scene. Please go ahead. I apologize.
Right. So they're saving Roberto da Costa, which is, by the way, one of my favorite New Mutants. So it's exciting to see him. But they fight. And again, the characters are not only showing off their powers, but they're showing off what they're doing. And X-Men 97 manages in the first 5 minutes to do what five seasons of the animated series could not do, which is to make Cyclops cool.
It doesn't even start with Cyclops, though. It starts with the great scene of them bringing in, Roberto, and you have, the weather, and they start to see their own breath in there. And that is beautiful. Squeed right then, because you get to see Storm's real power, and you have Storm and Bishop doing something cool before he goes sideways. And then they make Cyclops the badass that we always knew Cyclops was.
Right. Because honestly, Cyclops in the animated series was basically a hall monitor. You can't do that. You can't have fun. You're not allowed to go there. I mean, that's basically Cyclops in the animated series. And this one's like, oh, no, he got you to be a leader. And his eye blasts are cool and also not heat.
All right. So you're making a joke. But so in the Discord, we talked about Cyclops and the optic blast, and there was a huge discussion about it. And for a while, they were heat based. Some of the times, he absorbs it from solar energy. My preferred Cyclops optic blast is there is an optic blast universe, and Cyclops's eyes are a conduit to that universe that he shoots them out from.
I don't know
why I love it.
That's just science.
I just love it so much.
I mean, the what I love about that is, first of all, it's think about this. There's an entire dimension that is just made up of blast energy. That's all it exists for. It's just a little dimension full of red eye beams. And then someone's mutant power is to be a dimension. Their eyes are a dimensional portal. And it's just like, no, we can't just have eye beams. No, it's got to be way fucking weirder than that.
My question for you, though, person that loves Cyclops, who came up with the optic visor and the ruby and the ruby lenses?
Stan Lee / Jack Kirby. I don't know who of them gave that team.
I mean, in universe.
Oh.
So there you go. You stumble over Scott. He's blasting to the heavens with his optic blast, and he doesn't hit you. Who decides, you know what? Ruby Quartz.
Mr. Sinister.
Lock that visor.
Mr. Sinister did. Now, originally, Professor Xavier said, we tried a few things, and we discovered it was Red Quartz, but retroactively, because X-Men loves a fucking retcon, Mr. Sinister specifically designed Scott and had the antidote ready and then told Professor Xavier through cutouts, this is what he needed to use.
I just wanted you to say it.
So one of the reasons why I love Jay and Miles, X-Men, X-Men, because every episode is Jay explaining to Miles some ludicrous part of X-Men. They have had 400 episodes and they have not run out of material. Because this whole continuity is just stupid.
I love it so much.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to make another Cyclops show. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to go back to recovering the episode like we're supposed to.
One of my favorite parts for the opening scene, when Roberto says, are you one of the good guys? And you get Cyclops getting to quote, definitely. And Ding doing the cool move where he dodges around the Friends of Humanity with his optic blast on the floor. That is peak awesomeness.
Yes, absolutely. I also love that this episode inspired a whole bunch of people to be mad online saying that this was obviously a reference to Trump supporters. And I love it because A, it's not. It's from a 30-year-old storyline, but also B, it absolutely is a reference to Trump supporters because that's how this has aged so well. That some of these themes are still resonant fucking today.
We could go all the way back to 1865 if you want and still have it be pertinent and resonant.
Well, you're damn right.
That is how sad the world is.
Right. but I love when you can point to something and people are like, oh, that was obviously added because woke. And it's like, no, it's a reference to a thing that's old, which means that your ideology is outdated by your own argument.
And my last bit for this is that you get them taking off Cyclops' visor and you get the gag from back in the animated series where he says, I give up, and dropping a knot as he blasts the entire scene and ends. And like, that's how they end it. Like,
yes. Yes.
Instant buy-in.
Yes.
The thing I want to talk about, though, is how they use the newspaper that floats out from there to fast forward you up to where we are now. It was a very nice touch also. Like, just retelling the story, letting you know how things have changed, but how nothing has changed.
Right, because I, anticipating that Chris is probably going to do slightly more research than I did not bother to rewatch the animated series. I tried to watch it again about a year and a half ago. I watched about a season and a half in, and it kind of just fell off. So I was like, I bet you never seen season 5. So I was like, I'm just going to go in and see what happens. And I was caught up very clearly. Again, like, you have to have a certain amount of, wait a minute, this guy, I tried to assassinate Professor Xavier. When if you don't know who Professor Xavier is, you probably shouldn't be watching this show. But it does a really good job of saying, yeah, no, this is the next season of a show that hasn't been on for 30 years. So we're just going to keep going. But it didn't leave viewers behind, because the only thing that matters is Charles Xavier is gone. And that only matters because you have to see an episode of the team trying to come to terms with that, trying to go on with their lives before Magneto upends that status quo.
And the best part is, it's written so well that you don't even need to know who Xavier is, just that they've lost a mentor figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's... And the transition to the X-Mansion, where you have your melodrama suddenly with Morph, who's changing forms, you've got Gambit, who's fixing breakfast, Rogue, and Cyclops being the hall monitor.
Also, although I don't particularly swing this way just from a representation standpoint, I do appreciate that Gambit wearing the half shirt with the six pack under it while making breakfast. I was like, you know what? Thank you for providing cheesecake for other parts of the audience.
It's beautiful, because then you even have Jean come in, you get like the jokes and the gags, and you can see that Jean's pregnant, so you automatically can associate her and Cyclops are going to have a kid, and it's telling you all this right before, like 3 minutes before it then tells you verbally from other characters, giving you exposition.
Right, right. There is a lot of, there's a lot of show and tell, right? They're showing you something and then telling you, like you said, later. Because there's frankly a lot of ground to cover here, and they have to assume most people are watching it kind of like I am, which is that probably haven't watched it in 30 years. Maybe I've seen a few episodes between now and then, but I'm not caught up to date. Let's get everyone caught up to date. But they do it, like I said, in a very non-info dumpy way, which is appreciated. But also I see why they dropped the first two episodes for 1 week, because this episode is pretty much set up. It's a great episode. It's great setup. But if I just watched this and waited a week, I could kind of see people going, this is kind of a slow show. It's not. It is absolutely not a slow moving show.
It's only slow, how you were saying, if you hadn't like rewatched it before, but having rewatched enough of the previous animated series, for me, the mic drop of Magneto having the X-Men would have been great for a week. But I've also been reliving it. So I'm like, oh, what's going to happen now? Compared to other people, it's like, meh.
I could see them going, well, again, like also we have the Sentinels back, and it's like, we're going to have Sentinels come back just to get beat up and ostensibly go off screen. We find out later in the season that's not entirely true, but it seems like this episode is just, let's bring the robots out again so we can beat them up and show off the cool powers. I like the fact that the show is playing with those expectations a bit, because part of the reason why the Sentinels were such an attractive opponent in the animated series is because it was one of the things the Sentinels allowed the X-Men to actually beat up.
I don't want to get there yet, because that fight scene is epic.
Right. But yeah, so you bring Master Mold back, you bring Bolivar Trask back, kind of recap again that first season, because the whole first season was a Bolivar Trask Sentinel season. So it's like, let's kind of do our homage to the first season that most everyone remembers. So it was a smart choice.
And you also get a replay of them bringing in a new mutant into the X-Men fold with Sunspot, how they did it originally with Jubilee. And you get the parallel between those two characters' journeys, which for Sunspot does not want to use their powers compared to Jubilee, who didn't understand their powers. And that is a nice parallel too, if you've watched them in unison recently. And to have the Wolverine scare of Sunspot in the danger room, to have him then flee. Because if I remember right, Jubilee also fled. So you get those almost exact parallels of the show, but slightly different arcs and journeys.
Yeah. To briefly jump ahead to the intro for episode 2, another thing they do is in the original animated series, there's a scene of Jubilee running to a fence when there's people running behind her, and then there's an X going across the fence before it cuts to the next scene. In the beginning of the next episode, Robert DaCosta does the exact same thing. So again, making a very clear subtext that Robert DaCosta is now our viewpoint character that Jubilee had before, and Jubilee has now evolved into being a full member of the team. She's no longer the kid circuit character still learning. Again, that the waters get muddied a little bit as we go through the season, but that's clearly where the show is positioning, and I think it's a smart move.
Mm-hmm. And to fast forward just a little bit, I will not get bogged down in the minutia of the nightclub scene, which is still pretty funny. The invasion of Trask's mind by Jean is definitely a change in approach for this series to start with compared to the original animated series. And then you get the Cyclops' glimpse that Cyclops was potentially going to be a darker version for this. Because you get the fact that Xavier would have tried to work with you. I don't have time for that. And then it clicks over to have Jean just rip information from him.
This is something that's adaptations of well-loved, well-known franchises who are specifically playing through a known continuity have to struggle with, right? As much as I have and probably will, given I know what's coming in the future, we'll give stick to the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock. One of the things the first season does really well is if you're very familiar with the stories, it starts to build you towards an expectation and then goes a different direction, while also putting in teases for things that people who are aware of the canon go, oh, I recognize that. I think I know what's happening there. And so this is kind of similar. It's like when the animated series was on, it was mining originally the first kind of 30 years of X-Men comics. There's now a whole new 30 years of comics they can mine. And so rather than just sticking to the 90s continuity, they are doing things like teasing, well, like I actually think of as terrorist Cyclops, where, you know, he decides that he needs to just be completely in control of how mutants are treated and will do anything necessary to do that. He very much falls in that line. And we see a glimpse of that here, which if you're just watching the show, it's like, oh, Cyclops is slightly harder edge, but he's lost his father figure. I guess that makes sense. But people who are familiar with comics go, oh, I think I know what's happening there. Whether it does or not, it doesn't matter. You get the satisfaction of seeing that note because you're familiar with continuity and it doesn't interfere with people who don't have that knowledge, which Marvel, frankly, has not been great at in the past.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's so great about Cyclops, at least for me, when done properly, is that Cyclops is an amalgamation of both Magneto and Xavier.
Yes.
And this is like old school Xavier before they added in the multiple layers of evil to Xavier, just when he was creepy dad, not maniacally creepy dad.
Right.
And so he gets those because he has Xavier's dream, but then he has like the reality that Magneto also has. And so you get that weird middle ground where he's not fully one or the other, but sort of becomes his own thing and becomes more pragmatic in the comics to evil.
Right. And this is one of the places where the adaptation version works a little bit better, because in the original comics, when Magneto took over, the X-Men were done. Right. They were off on their own. So Magneto was primarily running the New Mutants. And so for a minute, I was like, oh, I kind of want to see the Magneto trying to lead and figure out a new team thing, because I love Magneto and New Mutants. Right. But this actually does work better because it puts Scott, as opposed to an ideological conflict with Magneto, he's now in direct conflict with Magneto. And so they're compressing a lot of what the Magneto dynamic of the 90s and early 2000s is into Magneto is now in charge of the X-Men, not Magneto's in charge of the school, which handles the junior X-Men.
Which for me, I also like this version better because they are adults and they choose to be here. The New Mutants didn't have that option. Like, Magneto is a schoolmaster. We can't leave because of law. And so right. That changes the entire dynamic and flow of everything, which is very nicely done. To move us on, because we've got a couple of episodes to cover. the hunting down the Sentinels in basically the Sentinel graveyard. Loved it. I love my horror Sentinel that's like slightly broken and decaying and it looks like it's falling apart, but still a horrible threat. And the best Cyclops scene of the entire series so far is he orders Rogue and Storm to sort of like carry everyone else, and you get the Cyclops fall to then have a heroic landing using his own optic blast.
Yep, right.
That I want to see it every week.
So great, yeah. And to be clear, I mean, Chris joked earlier that I'm a huge fan of Cyclops. I really wasn't. I got more appreciation of Cyclops through Jay, because Jay is an unabashed Cyclops apologist on Jay and Miles. But I was like, oh, hey, I guess I respect Skylar more than I thought. But this show made me a fan of Cyclops, specifically.
And I've always kind of liked Cyclops, but then again, I think I have a general disposition to like the leader, because I understand that is a shitty role to be stuck in, and you have to put the team before you put yourself. Mm-hmm. But of course, they beat the Sentinels. Everything works out great. And then we get our Magneto cliffhanger. Anything else for this episode?
Nope, let's move on to the next one.
Season 1, Episode 2. Mutant Liberation Begins. Magneto begins saving both humans and mutants and refraining from killing anti-mutant militants. A distrustful Cyclops and Jean decide to stay with the X-Men, while Rogue sympathizes with Magneto's struggles. Is it more than sympathy? When the UN forces led by Dr. Valerie Cooper attempt to arrest Magneto for his past terrorism, he agrees to surrender after scaring the ever-living shit out of them and face trial to prove himself. During his trial at the UN headquarters, the Friends of Humanity stage an attack. Their leader, the Executioner, shoots Magneto with a depowering radiation blast, but Storm takes a hit for him and loses her abilities. Jean goes into labor, and Rogue absorbs the knowledge of a doctor to deliver the child. Jean gives birth to a son whom she and Cyclops name Nathan. Will not ever come up again, is unimportant to the rest of X-Men history.
That's good.
After Magneto apprehends the Executioner, terrorizes the council, and the X-Men stop the assault, he's pardoned, and discussions begin with Genosha about becoming a member of the UN. Beast tells Storm that the blast has permanently depowered her, and she makes a very difficult decision and leaves the team. While discussing her decision, the X-Men are surprised by the sudden arrival of a woman who looks identical to Jean.
So, now we're getting into what I mentioned before about how later seasons tended to compress storylines. In this episode, we have the entire Trial of Magneto storyline. We have, as far as I can tell, the entire Executioner Song storyline. We have the start of Life Death. We have the start of Inferno. We have a reference to a much later storyline, the retcon of Rogue and Magneto. There's a bit of the X-Factor storyline with Valerie Cooper and how she's plays into everything. And this is all in 29 minutes. There's a lot happening.
And this is where I dropped in the Discord that I think it is going through too much of the show too fast.
Right. And initially I pushed back on that, because I remember in the conversation, I was like, this is the same cartoon that crams all of Warlock's storyline into 22 minutes. But the thing is that this, if it was just one or two episodes, I'd be like, okay, they're just rewriting things. But this is a trend going forward, is they're going to keep cramming lots of story into a small space. Now, I will say, to the show's credit, it doesn't feel cramped. They do a very good job of very carefully pulling and rearranging story beats to feel a little more organic. So like having the Executioner Song and Trial Magneto overlap actually makes a degree of sense, because they both ultimately hinge around the Friends of Humanity storyline. Those happened in sequence, kind of just collapsing together makes a degree of sense. Having Magneto starting off being benevolent and then ending with a mission statement of why he's being benevolent, it makes sense, because one thing this show is doing, which is interesting, to go back to my earlier point about they're keeping some of the original standards, is they're trying to keep each episode relatively, even though it's serialized, they're trying to keep each episode relatively self-contained. There are subplots that will feed through the season, like they always did, but the A plot of each episode begins and ends inside the episode, which is something a lot of streaming TV does not do right now. So it feels very evocative of 90s television in that regard. And so if you're going to make that decision, then yeah, you have to compress a lot. It's just to have all that going on again, like on some level it feels overbloated, but then like having Storm subplot and Jean subplot happening does feel to the soap opera vibe of the show. So it's not bad per se. I enjoyed the episode. I very much knew it. But again, this is where the fan in me is going, wow, we just clipped through like 100 issues of comic.
Yeah, which is still, in my opinion, kind of outrageous. Now, to give it its props, how you're saying it, I like the fact that, though, in that 29 minutes, they took a beat that at the start to kind of have Storm and Marvel Girl discuss how MG wants her baby just to be normal and human, so not to go through the struggles they go through, and have Storm kind of reflect on that, saying that she's always wondered what it's like to have, if she had been born human. And then make it, and then immediately following up, but that meant I would have never had the life that I've had now with all of you.
And since we're at that moment, a couple things for it. One is I'm really glad that, because the Jean Storm friendship is one of the smaller bits of the original comic run that I think are not celebrated enough, because it is fantastic to see female friendships in comics that don't involve fighting over a man.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a genuinely good female friendship that I think is not celebrated enough. But the other is, this episode really helped me cement the both really good and really bad of bringing the original voice actors back, right? Because the original voice actor, okay, so the original voice actor did both Storm and Rogue. These are the two points I'm talking about here. The original Storm is a little too bombastic and feels stilted sometimes. She has aged extremely well. She has hit the exact perfect balance of bombast and emotion that Storm absolutely needs, and it is the absolute best version of Storm. I've always been partial to the anime version of Storm, but now it's like even better, which I didn't think was possible. She was absolutely the right call to bring her back. Storm sounds like an old woman, and it's hard to get past that.
Storm sounds like an old woman, or do you mean Rogue?
Rogue sounds like an old woman. Thank you. Rogue sounds like an old woman, and it's hard to get past that. No, Storm sounds amazing.
And Jean, if I remember correctly, though, Jean is voiced now by Jennifer Hale, who is not the original actress that voiced her from the original animated series. I think Jennifer Hale started voicing her in the X-Men Evolution series and has done that in video games, everything since then.
Right.
The incredible Jennifer Hale, though, who has a great history and has done some amazing work.
She's a fantastic voice actor. And digression, but the Cyclops is a new actor, and I did not know that until I looked it up, because he sounds exactly like the animated Cyclops in my head, but a better version of that. So he absolutely understood the brief, and it's like, this is Scott from the animated series. What are you talking about? Oh, it's a completely different actor. Well, I never would have guessed.
I think he's definitely channeling the actor who passed away, which is why they're not brought back.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. Okay.
So you can feel it, and that's such a nice taste. And
no, it is such a respectful take, yeah.
How you're feeling about Rogue, I feel kind of like that about Wolverine.
Yeah, because there's some energy missing from that.
While Logan is hundreds of years old, Logan shouldn't feel hundreds of years old.
Right, right.
But they're still doing good work. It just feels somewhat of a disconnect sometimes watching it transpire on scene.
Right, right. And so initially, I was like, wow, except for Storm, I only like the new voice actors. I've since watched more episodes that just been moderated somewhat. I feel differently about all of that. But Rogue just continues to stand out specifically. But aside from that, like, it was more the point, like, it was this episode that I started actually thinking about the voice acting in any real level, because all of it just sounds like the show to me. Right? No one sounded really off. And then Magneto started talking more. Initially, Magneto sounded very rough and hoarse to me, but then when Magneto started getting going and started doing long speeches, like, okay, that's the Magneto I remember.
And it's interesting seeing Magneto go down to where the Morlocks were, because I've never thought of Magneto and the Morlocks operating in the same space. I don't know why I haven't,
yeah.
just doesn't didn't resonate with me, hit me before until seeing it on screen, going, oh, very nice. Right.
In other news, the Executioner is still a stupid character and a stupid concept, but at least this episode recognizes that is kind of a lame concept.
What? What? You're right. There's.
I'm sorry. My apologies. Executioner. It's not Executioner. It's Executioner. That's how it's spelled.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, we'll move ahead. The subplot of Gene getting to the hospital, by the way, utterly ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Just nonsense. I love it.
It hits down. And like ripping the top of the Jeep off.
And again, that's one thing that I love about the X-Men is that like it's, I keep saying soap opera, but it's really relevant because it is this heightened sense of drama, and Collateral Damage is part of a supernatural soap opera, and X-Men have always heavily leaned into that. It's like, if there's something we can tell a compelling story, that's great. But if we tell a compelling story while ripping the roof off of Jeeps or destroying the UN building, that's even better.
And something else, this show replicates part of the issue that the comics themselves tried to address head on when they first came out in the Jim Lee comic. And that was, what do you do when you have 13 to 15 X-Men operating out of the same manner together?
Right.
And for them, you break them into two teams, like the gold and the blue team, and they would do different operations, but they're always operating out of the manor together.
Right.
And the show has part of that where you see they break off and you send a certain number of X-Men to do something, and for some reason, everyone else is just chilling in the manor, or not on screen, but definitely not in the mission.
Right. But the other thing it's doing, which is something that is a throwback all the way to what Chris Claremont wanted to do, is the idea that the X-Men have lives and rotate in and out of the team. So, you know, by the end of this, we have Jean having a child and talking about leaving Storm leaves. So the idea that the X-Men roster is not static is something that was built in, not from day one, but certainly since Claremont took over the book.
To some extent. But once all the original OG X-Men left, and Cyclops had a weird like yo-yo relationship, I'm gone.
Well,
I'm back.
Editorial realized that it was popular, and so they didn't want to break up the team, which is not what Claremont wanted. Because Claremont, that spoilers for, again, 50-year-old comics. When Cyclops originally met Madeline Pryor and then wanted to leave the team, that was originally it. He was going to just go off into the sunset with Jean's clone, and that was it. He was going to have a life.
Yeah, on his fishing boat.
Yeah, on his fishing boat before they crashed onto an island that was totally controlled by Magneto and not at all by Cthulhu. Because X-Men.
But you had a great team then. You had like Storm, Wolverine, Colossus, Nightcrawler, and I'm forgetting, I think, one other person. Kitty Pryde, Shadowcat.
Yeah.
Like that is a solid core team.
Yeah, it is. So I understand editorial's reluctance.
So back to the episode. I guess we should just do like an X-Men comic run. We like pick some arcs. We just talk about
probably,
them.
Probably, maybe.
You get the trial of Magneto, and you have this massive crowd of people outside. They eventually sort of come inside. The fact that Storm tries to take a bullet from Magneto still makes no sense to me. I understand why they did it for the show and her arc and everything else, but that moment doesn't feel earned for me, given the short amount of time we have had from episode 1 to episode 2. And part of that is going to be because of how they condense the story. There was so much story went by. It should feel like more time has gone by, but it hasn't.
Right.
It's been
right.
Maybe a week, less than a week. And Eddie, if you were my archenemy and you came and teamed up with me in 1 week's time, I would not be willing to take a bullet for you. Even if you're proving yourself as like a little bit more, a little bit more.
Well, and specifically Storm, right? Like I could see Scott doing that. I could see Jean doing that. I can even see Beast doing that, because these are all characters that have a willingness to try to see the good in people. And Storm has that too, but that's not where she's at right now, mm-hmm. right? After the events of season 5 into this is a Storm that is kind of getting a little harder edge. There's a reason why she has the mohawk now, is because she's starting to realize that her she views as his naivety has cost her a lot. This is the same Storm who kicked the shit out of someone to get control of the Morlocks, right? I mean, so
she beat Callisto
down. Very different place. So it doesn't make sense for Storm specifically to have done that.
And so, yeah, I agree with you.
I can't see Cyclops doing it. Well, okay, maybe Cyclops at this point also, maybe not. But my point is, like, other characters could have done that role.
Yes.
The reason why it's Storm is because it was Storm in the comics that went through life death.
Yeah. Although I myself would like to see the story where, for instance, Wolverine or Cyclops or Beast jump in there and then they go on a personal journey and they meet and fall in love, spoiler, with Forge. I would have liked to have seen that story arc. Because while we're talking a lot of good stuff about the show, what it does lack is that that kind of relationship for it.
Oh, yeah. No, I would genuinely like to see a Forge-Beast relationship. They could just be science lovers and make crazy shit and accidentally destroy the world.
But to this point specifically, like, we have Jean, Cyclops, and Jean. We've got Rogue, Gambit, and Magneto. But we don't have, like, a Wolverine morph or a Beast Forge relationship at all throughout the show. And we've even got, like, a Roberto and Jubilee.
Right. Yeah. It is very heteronormative in that regard.
Anything else about this episode?
Nope. Let's move on.
I will say that one of my favorite characters in the new series, though, is I like what they've done with Morph.
Yeah.
I love Morph so much. I love, like, the acting. I love the ability that they've given Morph. They've improved Morph so that Morph just can't resemble the person, but takes on, like, the physical aspects of the person with their mutation, which is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of mimic, but it's a good combination. And also, it allows them to do cameo appearances from fan favorite characters. And Morph is that kind of character who would go, hey, this person was cool. Let's bring them back. So it works for a lot of levels. So yeah, Morph is great.
And the other level that I love that it's working on is that by changing those characters, it is showing that they've interacted with them, how you were saying, and that expands the universe of the animated series without costing any budget or anything else. Brilliant. Right. Like, now I want to know, when was the story where they met Magic? How does he know about this person? How did they figure this out? How did they do this?
Hence my confusion.
Season 1, Episode 3, Fire Made Flesh. Beast determines that the Jean lookalike is actually the real Jean. The villainous Mista Sinister contacts the other Jean, revealing her to be a clone he created to gain access to her and Cyclops' DNA. Sinister takes control of her mind, turning her into the Goblin Queen. She gives Nathan to Sinister and subjects the X-Men to horrific visions based on their own fears. Morph, who was previously corrupted and controlled by Sinister, leads the X-Men to one of Sinister's labs where they find him infecting Nathan with a techno-organic virus under the belief that it will make the child invincible. Bullshit. The real Jean confronts the Goblin Queen telepathically and uses their shared memories to free her from Sinister's control. The clone Jean and Cyclops save Nathan by giving him to Bishop, who goes into the future with their child. I want to stop and talk about that for a second. The clone Jean gives Nathan to Bishop to take into the future, and Cyclops walks out because he has abandonment issues from his own father. The clone Jean then takes on the name Madeline Pryor and leaves the team. Elsewhere, a mutant named Forge rolls up on a depowered Storm in a bar and claims he can restore her powers.
So now we've gotten through all of Inferno. We've gotten through, spoiler, Cable's origin story. We've gone through the entire Mr. Sinister retcon backstory. And we tack on a chunk of life death onto here.
Too much, too much, too much.
First of all, we need to take a moment to appreciate just how deeply creepy Mr. Sinister's plan is. I'm going to make a clone of a woman so I can get her knocked up because I want this specific guy's semen to make a mutant baby that I can then inject with a techno-organic virus, which was a MacGuffin from 3 seasons ago, to make this specific baby invulnerable. And yet, this elaborate plan of Mr. Sinister's did not take into account, maybe I should have checked techno-organic virus first before I went ahead with this plan. Because Mr. Sinister is the Cobra Commander of plans.
All we don't know. For all we know, he may have had some genetic thing that would have made the techno-organic virus to make Nathan invulnerable if they left that baby in a tank without any breathable oxygen floating in some substance for like an hour.
I mean, for me, Mr. Sinister, which to be fair, later combo versions have kind of come around to this too, is that Mr. Sinister doesn't so much do plans because they're good, but he does plans because he thinks they'll be the most dramatic. And I can't completely disagree with that. It's like, okay, I know I could put a, you know, actually just clone a baby from their DNA, but this will be way more dramatic.
I think it's the grade of DNA he's looking for. He's not looking for like leftover DNA, but he wants actual at moment of so-and-so DNA to have occurred.
Again, this man is way too into the private parts of these two people. It's deeply creepy.
Well, technically, so was Xavier, wasn't he?
No, oh, I'm not disagreeing with that at all. I'm just saying, Mr. Sinister.
I had a friend whose favorite X-Men character out of all the X-Men rosters was Sinister. And
why?
I don't know. I still don't understand. I don't get it. But that was their person.
But again, like, I'm not mad at this episode. I mean, it was, again, very fun episode. But there's certainly a lot of it that happens just because that's what happened in the comics. Like,
but it squandered so many storylines and so many great things. Like Inferno, as someone that loves Inferno and as someone that is a superhero fan and a horror fan, I giggled to see the horror aspects of it. But Inferno should have been, if they want to condense it down, 3-episode arc where you could have gotten into like the nitty gritty of it. But I don't know if Disney wanted demons running around on their show and to talk about magic, the dark child being stuck in hell for like centuries.
Right.
And if you're not going to do that, then you should just kind of like whoop over that one.
Well, I think it's what they did, honestly. I think it's just the Goblin Queen kind of was just like, okay, no, she's just kind of evil Jean Grey for a minute. Okay, we're fine now. But like, the problem is then the fact she's called the Goblin Queen has no context.
Yeah.
Why is she called the Goblin Queen? She just kind of goes crazy and changes her outfit for a minute, which in all the various Jean Greys is kind of a thing she does naturally, so it doesn't need to be really explained. And then there's no context for why she takes the name of Madeline Pryor. The Sinister stuff admittedly was set up by the show prior, so I can't really be mad about that because the previous seasons did set up the whole Sinister thing, so I'm not going to ding that one. Specifically, the Madeline Pryor thing.
I've got a ding for the Sinister thing, though.
Oh, okay.
Morph knew where Sinister was this whole time, and they didn't tell the team.
Oh,
we've had
like
a year or two. You know what? I know where Sinister is, team. We could have gone and taken care of this at any point in time.
Yeah, that's fair. Morph going, oh, you know what? Now that's plot relevant, I do know where Sinister's at. That's fair. That is entirely fair.
But to your point about Madeline Pryor, utterly agree. Completely on every level. There's why.
Right. So as much as in the last episode, I was like, yeah, no, I think they did a good job of shuffling it to make those combinations. This swings a little too far into, no, these things didn't happen because this is what happened in the comics. And I'll talk about this more in the next episode, but this is the start of a trend that I'm against, like, again, kind of see the logic of, because this is also homaging an era where Claremont and then later Jim Lee would have subplots happening to the point where the actual issue of the comic would have like a roughly 16 page front half and then like a 6 to 8 page back half. And so there would be like literally a secondary story. And so you're starting to homage the idea that these stories are now moving so far apart that the plot threads are starting to interweave into the episode, which is something that modern television does very, very well. 80s, 90s television didn't do at all. And so we're starting to see an attempt to do a kludge of that. And so when I watched this episode, I was like, oh, okay, so the life death thing is going to be kind of just a thread that's going to slowly get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're going to weave it into the episode. That is not what happens, and I'll be mad about that when we talk about next episode. But it's this episode is kind of it's muddy, right? I think they don't quite know what they want to do with the show, which is weird because the first two episodes are very strong. What their thing is, I feel like they're okay. Now we want to try to do another thing, and that one doesn't quite land for me.
Agreed. And while I give them a lot of kudos for the first one that really built on itself, and the second one too, this gets to a point where it feels more inclined that they know there are so many great X-Men stories that if I just pull in the higher beats of them and drop them into an episode, it'll sing and work. And on some level, it does. Like, this is all great things, you know, I threw them all in there, so now this is a great episode. And that makes me very curious about what's going to happen in season 2 and 3, where you've pulled all the great stuff from the past 30 years and put them in the first season.
Well, I mean, to the point, it's like, I had thought 97's plan was we're going to do the rest of the 90s era of X-Men. But now that they have up to 3 seasons, it may be they're like, and then we're going to go into the Morrison era, and then we're going to go into, you know, the late early 2000s era. They may be doing everything up to modern day, you know, which means they have
Once you see episode 5, you will understand what I'm saying, because it feels like they're pulling stuff from last year.
Okay. Because I'm wondering if the Genosha thing is honestly, spoilers for well, receiving comments, I was wondering if the Genosha thing was pointing towards a new version of House of X.
It feels a lot like the Hellfire Balls and stuff from the more recent run of X-Men. Yeah.
Right. That's what I'm wondering.
Very much that feel to it.
Because it would be very easy to, you know, whether it's Krakoa or Genosha, so here's an island that mutants control. So doing that modern story of, and now they become a world power and they have their own culture and whatnot. It's a natural progression from the Genosha storyline that's been established way back from season 1 of the thing. So it wouldn't surprise me if they're again bouncing around the timeline to cover it. But if that means that then we're now up to at bare minimum 2018, you know, that means that they can speed run through it because they have a lot of comics to get through. But I agree with you. It does mean that they're leaving a lot on the cutting room floor. Like this, the whole Jean thing could have been an entire subplot for this whole season.
Yeah.
And it lasts one episode.
So it's, but as we're only discussing the first 4 episodes, and at time of airing, the whole 10 episodes have not dropped yet.
Right.
Time of recording, not time, I think time of airing too, because we're going to release this pretty soon. They have not dropped yet. So it could do anything. Maybe they could pull some shenanigans that then make it seasons 2 and 3, because they've already, I think, received approval that those are going to happen, will work.
Yeah, as I understand it, they got 1 season with the pitch. Then when they saw how excited people were about it, before they finished production season 1, they got the green light for season 2. And then when the first 2 episodes dropped, they got the green light for season 3. So Disney is very bullish on X-Men 97.
Because from my understanding, I think Beau DeMeo has wrote before they were released seasons 1 and 2 and provided pitch ideas for season 3.
Right.
So everything we get is going to be thanks to Beau DeMeo, regardless of whether or not that person still works at Disney or not.
Yeah,
no, they've given them their idea. I hope they were paid generously.
I'm sure they were. Well, I take that back. It's Disney, so I'm sure they weren't. But I will say, as someone who's also a fan of a cartoon that recently revamped a beloved 90s property, enjoy it while you can, because, you know, Lower Decks just got canceled, so we'll see how long this lasts.
People keep telling me about Lower Decks. I've seen a season and a half, and it's funny. It has not grabbed me, I think, the way it grabbed everyone else.
I think you have to have a specific love of 90s era Star Trek to really – it doesn't help that they're slow to introduce the Deep Space Nine references. They're getting there now. But aside from a throwaway reference to Quark, they've not really mined Deep Space Nine specifically. But I understand season 3, that starts to change around. I've only seen the first 2 seasons myself, so.
Okay. I think we stated literally on the first episode that I am not a big fan of Next Generation. That is not my Star Trek.
Right. They do. Well, we should probably talk about Lower Decks at some point, honestly. But I will just say in mild defense of it, it's a bit like this in the sense of it recognizes some of the weirdness of it. But this is a comedy, so they're leading into isn't it weird that Tom Paris turned into a space lizard because he violated the transwarp barrier? You know, and it's a show that does that. It's a show like, remember when the animated series had cat people as Starfleet officers? Well, now we have a cat person, you know. It's those kinds of super deep cuts, but it's also just a really solidly put together sitcom, which is one reason why I like it, because it's not just references. It's actually done as a sitcom structure, and so the characters have arcs and beats and whatnot. So
okay.
I think it's worth doing it at some point in time, but anyway.
That's for later.
Back to 77.
Goblin Queen makes no sense for being in this, being named that here. I will say, though, that it was worthwhile just to see Cyclops and Bishop team up and Cyclops blast Bishop and Bishop supercharge and eradicate
that.
A bunch of people. And they both turn and look at each other and say thank you at the same time. Like, yes. No, say you're welcome at the same time. You're yes. welcome. Like, teamwork.
Yeah,
my favorite thing about superheroes comics is when they do teamwork moves, because they are a fucking team.
And honestly, that's the other thing. It's like Bishop's mutant power so rarely comes up. He's usually just the time traveling guy with the gun. And so I was like, no, he absorbs energy, and here's a guy who ejects energy. Why does this not happen more often? So I'm glad that like these are people who are fan enough of Bishop specifically to say, let's show why this character is cool. Crammed into, and the fact they carved time out of it into this extremely overpacked episode was really cool.
And we get more of the building relationship between Roberto and Jubilee in the episode, because they're now actively hanging out and kind of, maybe, are they dating? You can't really tell. So you get more of that relationship build up. You get more of Morph flirting with Wolverine and tormenting Gambit all at once. Oh, beautiful. Look at the danger room. Magneto, Rogue, Rogue, Magneto, Rogue, Magneto. Pitch perfect.
Yes, yes. They're doing a really good job of, here are the subplots. Let's give them all a little bit of time to build them out, which leads into my frustration of how episode 4 pans out.
Any closing thoughts on this episode? My only thing is they've now taken Bishop off the board as he moves to the future with young Nathan.
Right. Yeah. Remember we said it was so cool they made him a full part of the team? Except he only lasts 3 episodes.
And if memory serves, they're also changing all the opening credit cards to reflect the current roster of the team, which is a very nice touch.
It is, but it also means that Bishop only gets 3 episodes of credit card, title card time.
Yeah. And I can't remember if Storms is still there. I think Storms is gone, even though she's technically still here, but she's not here.
She has moments like of the scenes. She's still in those scenes, but she doesn't have her name in the, you know, in the sky thing.
And as a parent, I like the touch of Cyclops not being able to make the decision to let his kid go away.
Right. Oh, I'd say one extremely minor point, and nobody cares about this but me, and I recognize that. The only thing I would have loved more if they had done with the credit sequence is if they had put in stereo at the bottom.
That is very much in anything.
Moving on.
Season 1, Episode 4. Montendo / Life Death Part 1. Jubilee wants to celebrate her 18th birthday at the arcade, but Magneto refuses and tells the team to focus on their training. Roberto consoles Jubilee, who is surprised to find a new Montendo video game console in her room. The pair are pulled into a video game based on her previous adventures, created by the alien enslaver, Mojo, who feeds off audiences' engagement. Jubilee enjoys reliving her past missions, but is convinced by an older digital copy of herself from the game's beta version that she would be living an empty life. The older Jubilee helps Jubilee and Roberto defeat Mojo. And it's so hard not to say Mojo, Mojo.
Mojo, Mojo.
And the pair return to the real world. Jubilee kisses Roberto. Forge takes Storm to his ranch, where he creates a machine that can restore her powers, though it seemingly fails. Storm rides a horse and has fun. Storm notices a strange owl flying around the ranch. When Forge admits that he designed the technology, which the mutant inhibitor colors and executioner's radiation guns were based on, Storm leaves in anger. The owl reveals itself to be the demon, the adversary! It brings Storm back to the ranch and poisons Forge. The fucking adversary.
Yeah.
Eddie, remember when I told you way back when that a friend of mine ran a Marvel Superheroes face rip campaign for me for like 4 years?
Yep.
And in the first year, I'd figured out their plot and I'd like screwed it up so much they brought out someone to like basically fuck with me and reset the thing.
Yeah,
they broke out the adversary who sent my character back in time. And I had to like get shit back in line. That is how fucking powerful the adversary is. Because when it happened, I was like, you know what? You're right.
Legit.
I can't do shit.
That's fair. I love / hate this episode.
Why is that?
Okay. I'm going to start with the positive. The Motendo chunk, right? This feels very much like it comes from the original cartoon. This is not a storyline at all. This is completely new for this series, as far as I'm aware. It is yet another riff off of Mojo has moved into new media. Now it's 90s era video games. It's exactly the kind of thing that they're like, that we're inspired by the comics, but it's completely new to the thing. It's the same kind of bonkers concept that is exactly 90s kids television. They layer into this a few things, one of which is a burning indictment for the video game industry, which I deeply appreciate as someone who works in that industry. They actually have a mature romance for both Jubilee and Roberto, which I appreciate. They brought back the original voice actor for Mojo, which just sounds amazing because Mojo is appropriately unhinged. Again, a little lower energy than I would have expected for Mojo, but I generally do appreciate it. And the fact, we talked about this earlier, but Abscissa, which is the older version of Jubilee, is actually played by the original voice actor. So Jubilee is played by a new voice actor who is of Asian descent. And so I appreciate that they found a way to bring that voice actor back in for doing the right thing.
And they get to make a gag about it because it's the beta version.
Yeah, so yeah, it's the original version. And the best part is I didn't realize it was a different voice actor. That's how good both the performances were. Like, I thought it was the same actor just doing both voices. And they know it's two completely different actors. I'm like, that's amazing. That's a team that really loves and respects what came before and found a way to make that work. Because it would have been much cheaper to simply hire the voice actor, go, do those lines and do those other lines, but slightly older. That would have been the cheaper way of doing it. They didn't. They took the extra expense to hire a completely new actor. Do that. I respect and appreciate that. Really don't have any notes on the Motendo chunk of it. The fact that we got that instead of an entire episode of Life Death is what makes me mad.
They should have been either or, I agree. Like, I would have liked another 10 minutes of Motendo.
Right, yeah, yeah. Honestly, that felt compressed. Although I did the time, it was actually reasonably close to the time of an original episode. All of these episodes are slightly longer than the original episodes. That one's actually pretty close to actually what the original episode was long. So, in a lot of ways, I see that as kind of an homage to, okay, let's do the most 90s version of this that we could possibly do. Cool. Also, down to the point where the Motendo console looks like a Sega Genesis / Mega Drive. So. Really love that. And they call it Motendo. There's lots of fun things happening there. I also would have been fine if the Life Death thing had been an ongoing, here's a scene happening across several episodes. Right?
Yeah.
Because in the original comics, it was a slow burn that was happening in the margins of the comics until they finally did Life Death as a full issue. But you had been invested in the Forge Storm relationship before that issue lands and the big reveal of him being behind it all happens, right? This is way too fast and way too compressed. So everything gets damaged by it. Because we have Roberto and Jubilee, which are not canonically a couple, having a nice, mature, for teenagers, relationship. And then we have these two adults having a relationship looks like it was written by teenagers. Because Forge is like, yeah, I made a machine. And she goes, well, I hate you, and I'm going to run off on a horse now. And it's just like, oh, Jesus Christ.
All right. I want to take a step back to Motendo. And I've enjoyed the fact that Sunspot has still not used her powers other than this to show, like, the risk of what their powers could be.
Yeah.
Regardless of the situation they're in, and shows a real hesitancy and fear of people finding out because he doesn't want his parents to know. that is constantly reinforced. And I love it. Until we're going to get the big reveal soon. You know it's coming until they're like, build it up to.
Right. But I mean, and the thing is, that's one reason why I love Roberto is because as a character in the original New Mutants, he has all of the bravado of a teenage boy, but he's actually deeply, deeply scared. And they're actually doing a really good job of reflecting that, which I was not expecting at all. I was like, there's no way. Of all the storm plots I thought they would hit, it's like they're never going to do the Sunspot justice. But they do the Sunspot. I mean, he's older. He's not like 13. You know, he's actually 17-ish. It's unclear at this point. But it still doesn't matter, right? They're doing a really good job of saying, oh, no, I got this. Also, secretly, I'm terrified. I'm going to murder everyone in my life because of my mutant power, which is great.
And I'm still waiting for Berto's best friend to come in. I'm waiting for my guy.
God, all Cannonball. That would be so good.
I'm not invulnerable while blasting. I'm waiting for it. I want it. I want to hear it.
He's the best boy. Sam Guthrie, you're the best.
Much like you, I have no real notes on that other than I wish it was a bit longer. But the life-death thing, it feels weird. It's clunky. It's not well integrated at all. And part of me is curious if they didn't know what else to do with Storm for most of this season, because they've already acknowledged that Storm is an Omega-level mutant who turned in the first or second episode sand into glass by making it so cold.
Right.
And they weren't sure how to handle that power set.
I mean, I don't know, because like on the one hand, all right, so let me take it back. I recognize some of this is me because I really love this comic book storyline and I'm seeing active damage on that comic book storyline. But one of the reasons why I love this is that this was an entire run in the late 80s. Because it's Mohawk Storm didn't have her powers for most of that run. And she was still running the X-Men, and in fact, leading the X-Men for a chunk of that, having no powers.
She beat Cyclops to take control of the X-Men. Yeah,
she kicked the shit out of Cyclops with zero powers, which showed that it is not Storm that matters. It's Aurora that matters. And that's one of the reasons why she became very high on my list of characters I really love in the X-Men. Because of the time when she didn't have powers. And so when I first saw her losing, I was like, cool, I would look forward to that. But that does mean she has to have the conflict with Forge. The other reason why I don't like this, and this I recognize maybe me not watching the last few seasons, so maybe addressed in that, is Forge is in the future in this continuity. Because he's the guy who gives Bishop all of his stuff.
Yeah. You say he can't live that long?
I'm saying Forge just kind of appears. There's no context for him. Now, granted, I do think maybe it was intentional. Like, we get rid of Bishop just as Forge comes onto the scene. So maybe there's an intentional design thing of Bishop can't go, hey, it's Forge. You're the guy who gives me all my stuff. You know? but it's he just literally just walks up to a chick in a bar and starts hitting on her. And now suddenly he's part of the storyline. I'm hoping there's more that either was or gets played out here.
It's not just any chick in a bar. That's Aurora. Do you know who else rolls up on Aurora and can't help themselves but hit on Aurora?
Dr. Doom,
Dracula, Archon, the lightning god of some alternate dimension. Like, it is every single person go, hey, so.
Oh, no.
Dr. Doom, every chance he gets, pops up. Hey, Aurora, do you remember me? I'm Dr. Doom.
Oh, hell, Calypso hits on her, too. I mean, like, don't get me wrong. It's Aurora. I mean, if you have a pulse, you're going to hit on Aurora. I completely understand Forge's instinct for it. I'm saying from a narrative perspective, it's just creepy guy at a bar hitting on Aurora. Now suddenly they're in love, and now suddenly he's a person. There was no, like, moments of him making the device that would have – if we'd had a moment of that or a moment of him – like, some guy we don't know is getting money from the FOH, and he's giving them weapons. And then we cut to this episode. Is that the same guy who did that? You know, something to help scaffold this up. This is such a compressed run that there's no time for any of that. And so I think it's doing damage to Aurora.
It does. And I think on the wall there might have been some photos or something of him, but you'd have to be like staring. Like, is that a photo of Forge and Valerie Cooper? But that's you staring at the wall and not at what's going on in front of you. So that's
Right, right.
It's all too condensed, is what we keep coming back to.
Yeah. And some of it, I mean, I'm moving to my wrap up, but just, I think some of it is, I just want to see more of this because it's a great cartoon and I'm really enjoying it. It's frankly, this is the most excited I've been about the MCU in at least a year. You know, after we took a break, we're like, we're not watching MCU for a while. I then watched What If, which I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. But it was not a, oh my God, I'm so glad What If's back. It was just, okay, that was fun. I'm glad I watched it. I didn't hate it. I enjoyed that time. This is something like, I want to go back and finish the series. I just have that time and I'm set that I'm actively enjoying and seeking out this show, which I've not felt with MCU in quite a while.
Which I think, though, you've also went back and you saw season two of Loki and some other things.
Yeah.
And for me, when we were done, I was done. I came back for What If season two because my daughter wanted to watch. I was like, sure, I'll give it a shot. And I enjoyed it. And we went and we saw the Marvels and I enjoyed it. But I have not seen Loki. I have not seen the new Ant-Man movie or whatever that shenanigans was or any of that. Because I was done. But this is something I actively chose to watch. And I was so excited that I suggested that we talk about it and then that we do a special about it. That's how excited I was for this.
Mm-hmm. And I was happy to do it. So this is the awkward place we sometimes land in where it's a show we both really like, but yet it's easier to talk about the flaws because the rest of the show would just be us going, oh my God, this is so good, this is so good, this is so good. So, I mean, I'm not – well, I am mad at Life Death, but, I mean, otherwise I'm not really mad at this show. I'm glad it's out there. I'm glad it's getting a couple more seasons. I'm glad we're going to have a lot more of this. But I'm hoping now that there's a couple more seasons coming and there's confidence, I'm hoping that they will ease up on the throttle a bit more.
Well, it'll be interesting to see season three, given that it probably will not have Bo DeMeo as a person that made the first two seasons.
Right, right.
To see how they institute their ideas for season three and to see if that one takes a more slower approach in the material they're covering. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think we've been pretty balanced about how we've talked about it. We've given a lot of praise for things that we really loved, and then we've gone into more detail about things that we had some issues with and explained why we had issues, just not saying, well, that sucked. It becomes more of, I think X sucks because, or X wasn't engaging for me because it was too fast. It skipped over these things that I really had hoped it'd done. So you're adding context to criticism, which makes it viable and, in my opinion, important.
It's almost like maybe we know what we're doing, Chris. I don't know.
Well, it's taken about 3 years. I think we're slowly getting there.
Still figuring it out.
Any other closing thoughts on X-Men 97? Ba-da-da-da.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I'm glad it's in the world. I keep hearing this somehow ties into the larger MCU, and I kind of just don't want it to. I'm hoping that there are people talking about, like, this is going to lead into the movies, and there's continuity between the movies and stuff. I'm like, please don't. Just make lesbians own thing.
Literally, I think this is the one series that has no direct ties to MCU. I want to even say that was, if you look at the wiki, the wiki says this is its own thing. Now, it's saying that now, but given after Deadpool and Wolverine and the Marvel Secret Wars reboot, where they probably just reboot the whole universe and pull in everything they want as a course correction, it could potentially become relevant and part of that universe. Because they're going to probably reboot and bring back a lot of characters, especially now that Robert Downey Jr. has received like his Oscar. He's like, you know what? MCU, I want to come back. And do you know how much money they pay Robert Downey Jr.? And now that he's the Oscar, and he's probably not going to get another Oscar in his lifetime.
Yeah.
Might as well make a whole bunch of money and do something that you enjoy I assume they would treat Robert Downey Jr. like a king.
So you're saying is if we get Iron Man back, it's because of Oppenheimer?
Yes.
Okay.
Which I've still not seen Oppenheimer. Neither I don't have a lot of interest in seeing it.
I don't know.
If he comes back, then that definitely is going to be a move back to the old status quo that I had a lot of problems with, because I think that is going to be the more successful model. And to some extent it was, because they cared more about those characters and they gave them good scripts and good writing compared to what they did after those characters went away. Yeah. But we're not here to have another discussion about Marvel in that aspect.
No, I bring it up only because this show really helped me with some of my superhero burnout that we got from doing our superhero run. I'm not quite, I'm going to take it back. I am reading superhero comics again, partially because of an upcoming thing that we're going to do soon. But also a little bit of more because I want to. Still not quite ready to start reading X-Men again, just because it's so hard to find a point to dip back in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was off and on reading House X, and I really enjoyed that, but now it's done. So it's like, I don't think I'm going to follow month to month anymore. But I don't want to necessarily go back and read Chris Claremont. I want to read the 90s run again, but again, that's so dense. Where do you start with that? I mean, start with Jim Lee, but then that also builds on other stuff. And there's it's one of the downsides of X-Men is it is so dense that it's hard to find a way in sometimes. That's one of the reasons why the animated show I think was so successful, because you didn't need one. You pretty much hit the high points. This is just maybe a little too high points.
Do you know who could probably answer that question for you?
J.M. Miles?
That's right. I'm willing to bet if you added them on Blue Sky or some social media, they would potentially give you a great starting point to jump back in at.
They actually do have a on their webpage, they actually have a, because they get the question a lot, they do have various starting points, although they haven't updated it in quite a while.
I know. That's why I was like, you should just ask them.
That's true. Hey, could you update that?
No. Or can you give me, a person that's read all this, just an episode to jump in on? That's the joy of social media and the horror of social media.
Yes, yes.
Because some creatives really like it, and some creatives are begrudging about it. And you don't know until you try.
I kind of fall into begrudging, honestly.
I am generally pretty affable about it, depending on what you ask me.
Well, that's fair. Some conversations I really enjoy. Some people, I think there's a balance. Sometimes people get a little too into, hey, you've answered one question, so now here's 75 more. And it's like, okay, you need to back off, buddy.
Final closing thoughts on this before we wrap up X-Men 97.
It's good. Watch it.
Agreed. Great. You should watch it. If we like how it ends, you never know. We might wrap this, might do one more X-Men 97 just to close out the rest of the season, since we've covered this much of it.
Yeah, maybe. Although, I wouldn't be mad if we did actually want to sit down and talk about, again, try to find a run, but a run of X-Men comics.
Cool. And for people that are curious, the thing that we keep talking about that's going to be the special is we're actually going to do an actual play on the genre. It's our first one ever for X-Men 97 / maybe X-Men comic run. I'll be the person that'll be sitting in the GMing chair. And Eddie, who's all playing in this game that volunteered to come over and do this with us?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that, and I don't have that list in front of me.
And that's why I was giving you an extra second of me just blathering on about me running it. And yeah, so one of the things that I've wanted to do from the start is that we want to try to keep things changing and fresh and always try to add in new things. And this idea for an actual play had been in the back of my mind since we started almost. I didn't know what it was going to be, but it was probably some show that we covered. And we went back and forth for a while, and I was like, let's do Sleepy Hollow. And he's like, I don't want to do Sleepy Hollow because I don't know anything about Sleepy Hollow that sure. way. And for I was sure. like, I want to shoot Ichabod Crane in the face. He's like, no. And so we ended up on X-Men 97.
Yes. And so aside from me, I'm playing, Chris is running. We're going to have Ariel Celeste, who chatted with us on Watchmen. Matthew Dawkins, who chatted with us on Kindred the Embraced. And Jennifer Kretschmer, which I think has not been on the show yet, right?
Not yet, but Jen is someone I've wanted to get onto the show for a while. Jen's a great person, is also one of the contributors for Haunted West, and has done some actual plays with me in the past for some reason. I don't know why they keep volunteering to do it, but I'm going to keep hanging out with them as much as they want to.
Nice. And so, yeah, after that, do you want to talk about our next run after that?
I think I will leave that. No, you know what? I will talk about that one, because the one after that is the one that you could talk about in more detail. At long last, we're going to go back to Speechless. We keep joking about Speechless for a while, and we went through different comics, bantering back and forth. But we're going to cover a comic series I read when it first came out that I liked, and I'm not sure of now because it's been so long. The Ultimates, the first graphic novel of it, issues 1-5. I think there's a 6th issue in the graphic novel, but that's something we're probably not going to do.
I have the I just got the collected version. I have finally started reading them, and so far I've been enjoying them. So I'm looking forward to it. But I'm specifically reading episode to episode. I'm not reading ahead. So I want it to come to as fresh as possible. So I'm looking forward to this.
That's my plan. In fact, to read it 30 minutes before we directly 30 minutes before we get on the air to podcast together.
Right. I'm going to have some questions about continuity because how this fits in is a little fuzzy to me, but that's okay.
Then that means I may need to go read an hour before so I can figure out that continuity place. And that should probably be, I want to say it's about 5 weeks of stuff because we're going to cover each issue for one episode. And we may delve into a little bit of some of the characters and backstories and things like that, but it should be fun. After that run, Eddie, do you want to tell them what we're finally going to do?
We talked about it during the Doctor Who run too, but just to kind of reiterate, after that, we're going to do 80 years of Sherlock Holmes. We're going to do kind of a, in the inspiration of 97, we're going to do a speed run through the Sherlock Holmes continuity. We're going to kind of touch on various different decades of Sherlock Holmes adaptations. So that will be a lot of fun because I may know a thing or two about Sherlock Holmes.
Then otherwise, I will wrap up, and my final thoughts would be, to me, my X-Men.
We'll see you next week.